Welcome to the Sustainability Agenda podcast. My name is Fraggle Byrne. Every week I speak to leading figures from the world of sustainability and explore the sustainability agenda in marketing and strategy, technology, innovation, investment and finance. We look at the latest thinking, what's working and the future and evolution of the sustainability agenda. I'm very pleased today to welcome Tony Juniper to the podcast. Tony is a British campaigner, writer, sustainability advisor, and environmentalist who spent more than 30 years working for change towards a more sustainable society, making the case for new recycling laws, orchestrating international campaigns for action on rainforests and climate change, providing ecology and conservation experiences for primary school children. Today, Tony works in a variety of roles. He's a special advisor to the Prince of Wales International Sustainability Unit. He's a fellow with the University of Cambridge Institute for Sustainability Leadership. He's a trustee of Fauna and Flora International of Solar Aid, Ecologist Resurgent Magazine, and in 2015, he was declared president of the Wildlife Trusts. Well, thank you very much, Tony, for taking the time to speak today to the Sustainability Agenda podcast.
My pleasure.
So, 30 years or more working directly on environmental issues and many different issues in many different roles. Can you talk a little bit about the last few years and what your priorities are and what's on your mind?
I think over the last 5 years, and maybe 10 in fact, we've seen quite a shift in the way the agenda has been working. And I think it's fair to say that up until that point, there was still quite a lot of scepticism in some really quite important places. And of course, there's still pockets of that. We're getting some noise there.
No, I'm fine.
Okay, I've got a bit of feedback. There are still some pockets of that, but I think over the last few years, we've seen the acceptance that things do need to change and the penny beginning to drop amongst corporations and amongst many governments to the point now where we are in a period of very rapid transition. And for me, this has been a time of moving away from really trying to highlight the scale of the challenge and to begin working more in different ways towards implementing the solutions. It's always been a mix of the two, of course, but I think at the moment, we're definitely into a phase where people now are beginning to say, okay, we understand, and what are we going to do about it? And this is manifest in the rapid shift towards low carbon energy and transport, electric cars being the most recent focal point on that. There is a very prominent discussion now about circular economy ideas and moving towards the recapturing of resources to fuel the next round of economic development, and a big focus on sustainable agriculture, not only in terms of how we're going to reduce emissions and reduce pollution, but also conserve natural habitats, including tropical rainforests. That's now really on the agenda amongst some major agricultural and resource companies. So that is all relatively quite new, and I think it's a very dynamic space and one which is extremely exciting. And I think, you know, by the early 2030s, we'll probably get a sense of whether we did enough in time or are doing enough in time. So everything's still to play for, I would say.
Yes, very interesting. Now, clearly, many different factors coming into play here. Policy has been important. I think we probably notice it more now in the US, where there's going to probably be less policy. But I'm just wondering, clearly policy is very important. Similarly, stakeholders, consumers, and you know, just the general public have been a big driver of some of these issues as well. And corporations have come on board. I was wondering, a big question, but if you have a sense of the relative contribution to each of those, I mean, how important have they been, and how important do you think they are in driving the sustainability agenda?
Well, you're quite right, I think, to highlight those three groups of influence, the public, the companies, and the governments and policymakers. And I think what I've seen over the period that I've been involved in all of this is the relative shift of how they're playing more or less prominent role. And there are periods when it's governments who are setting the scene and banging the drum, other times when it's the public protesting and making demands on the politicians, and then other times when the corporations shift into a leadership position. And at the moment, I think probably actually, I would say that it's the private sector that is having the kind of driving role right now. And this is evident in countries like the United States, where you've seen, you know, the abdication of federal leadership on climate change, and indeed pretty much every environmental issue. And so some very substantial corporations now stepping up and saying, okay, well, we're going to do it anyway. You're finding in Europe, even where there isn't regulation yet on electric vehicles and phasing out diesel, the two things kind of running together, that's not quite there as a policy yet, even though there's been some vague announcements. And yet you've got companies like Volvo saying that by 2019 there will be no sole diesel and petrol vehicles on the road. They'll be all electric or hybrid is what they'll be producing as new models. So I do think there's reason to believe that the companies have kind of shifted a little bit ahead. And this is not only in the West, there's companies in Asia, forestry companies, who are saying, okay, we understand the problems of deforestation arising from oil palm and paper production. And these companies are moving ahead of governments there who are still saying, well, you know, let's clear more land for economic growth. And the companies are saying, well, no, let's not, because, you know, this is not only a bad idea from the point of view of the market and what consumers expect, it's also a bad idea from the point of view of rainfall and the extent to which we're going to be able to sustain agriculture anyway. So I think at the moment, the companies have moved a little bit ahead of the consumer even, and certainly in many geographies ahead of governments. And I think the reason for that is because they are able to take the slightly longer view. They've got very clever people working in them who are able to join the dots on some of these issues. But crucially, they've spotted this as a source of risk for their sector and indeed the entire economy. And so quite a lot of them are moving into really quite creative and strategic places. And this is, I think, quite encouraging. Obviously, there's plenty of laggards who haven't done this. But I think, you know, the ones that have spotted what is going on and what's likely to be the consequence of that are building competitive advantage that will require them to move anyway in a few years, even if they don't see it yet themselves.
Right. Very interesting overview there. I'm wondering also about investors, whether you have a perspective on that. That certainly the kinds of sums of money that are people are looking at being involved in it, certainly reaching the SDGs and you know, low carbon economy generally are kind of pretty eye-watering. How important do you think investors have been, or how on board do you think they are with the sustainability agenda?
Well, up until quite recently, they were almost nowhere. There was a niche group of them, the so-called sustainable responsible investment SRI, whatever they, socially responsible investment SRI group. But I think, you know, that was always going to be quite small, and in the end, actually, probably not that effective in shifting, you know, the bulk of finance. But things are beginning to alter now, and you can see again, as is the case with some of the corporations, a real sense of understanding risk in a way that they didn't before, and as a result of that, beginning to take different decisions. And I guess one of the most obvious examples of this, and it's kind of again manifest in what I just said about electric cars and other transitions going on, is the way in which this carbon bubble and the unburnable carbon issue has now begun to be understood by investors who previously saw a pretty safe return by investing in Shell, BP and ExxonMobil and people, but who it's been pointed out to that actually the assets that these companies have in the terms of oil and gas and then separately the coal companies, you can't burn it to stay below 2 degrees, never mind 1.5 degrees, and even for a 2 degree pathway, something like 2/3 of that has to remain in the ground. Now, if these companies are valued on the assets that they have, which in those cases is fossil fuels, and you realize that they're worthless because you can't use them, then this actually amounts to a huge systemic risk in that particular bit of the market, to the point where companies are saying, investment companies are saying, well, look, you know, this is looking like it's got no future. Let's move our money into renewables, into other sustainable sectors where there is a future. And so that's beginning to happen. And this is quite new. You can see a similar shift taking place in relation to some of the agricultural commodities, and indeed even in relation to factory farming. People are beginning to put two and two together and saying, look, you know, this actually is presenting a level of risk that we didn't see before and which we need to manage. And that means moving our money into different enterprises, or at least engaging with the people who are investing in these kinds of economic activities to get them to do something different over time to begin the transition. So the investment side, I think, is huge, growing, and probably actually, if I just answer the comments made a second ago about the relative impact between the public, the companies and the governments, it's probably the financial sector that is now probably the biggest rising force over the next couple of years, and one which is set to make quite an impact, I would say.
Right, that's very interesting. In this synoptic overview, I can't resist just getting your sense of the implications of the Trump administration. Already, we've seen some pretty
Yes, well, it's quite amusing at one level to see the transparency of the agenda there in basically appealing to a core vote with junk arguments that have got no foundation in reality. For example, the extent to which the climate change science is basically being questioned. And so, you know, it's obviously a strategy that's doomed to failure. It's just a question of how quickly it will fall over. But the effect of it, irrespective of that, has been the opposite to what Donald Trump would have hoped for, I dare say, insofar as many states and companies and cities in the United States have said, okay, well, you know, if you're not going to show leadership, we will. And what he might have done, actually, is accelerate the move towards low carbon rather than to slow it down. And also, you know, it's revealed some really big splits in the administration. I thought one of the more interesting things that was being said around that announcement of the withdrawal from the Paris Agreement was by Rex Tillerson, his own Secretary of State, who evidently has taken a more mature view of all of this and understood the economic implications of it. Basically, at the same time as the president was saying he's going to withdraw from Paris, Rex Tillerson was saying nothing has changed and we're going to continue with our low-carbon journey. He literally said that on the same day. So one can see the transparency of a political argument harnessing an environmental question in order to sustain the core vote. It's pathetic in the sense of the cynicism that lays behind it, and it's doomed to failure one way or the other. The question is just how quickly it will fall over.
Right, very interesting. I can't resist also, sorry, in the synoptic picture there, China. On the one hand, people are saying that it's very positive that they're going to take global leadership. At the same time, they seem to be trucking on ahead with their coal-fired power and so forth. What's your sense of the role of China?
Well, the Chinese are not deniers. They're not taking short-term political actions. What they are doing is looking at the long view and planning the transition of their economy from one place to another over a period of time. And because they are unencumbered with some of the political volatility of the West, they're very likely to do it. And actually, as part of my work with the University of Cambridge Institute for Sustainability Leadership, it is striking for me how much engagement we're now having with Chinese politicians and business people. And indeed, only this week, I've been involved with two major programs here in Cambridge, one with a group of mayors from Guangdong, the most important industrial province of China, and a group more of entrepreneurs from Hong Kong, who've been here in Cambridge with us, looking at how they can adopt strategies for sustainable business and sustainable policy going forward. And these people are very serious. And it's striking how many of them are being contacted through the program here in Cambridge at the moment, and how many of them are turning up compared to what we might see from American corporations. It is fascinating. And I do think in the next 5 years, we might find that China has replaced the United States as the driving force on climate change outcomes, and will be a positive force in shaping those outcomes. And the reason they will do this is because they're strategic and long-term, like some of the corporations. They're looking ahead. They can see the mega trends, the build-up of greenhouse gases, the resource depletion, the population growth, the extent to which new markets are emerging, the way in which systemic risk needs to be managed differently. And they're responding to it in ways that are mature, logical, sensible, and evidence-based. And as a result of that, I think probably they will be dominating some of these markets in clean technology going forward. And actually, it's quite interesting this week to hear the British government, in the form of Greg Clark, finally waking up and seeing that we've made some big errors in recent years. And instead of repeating some of the nonsense about the need to frack gas from beneath our little crowded island, we heard instead of the need to begin putting major investment into battery technology, which is exactly what China's been doing for a decade. Whilst we've been looking underground, they've been looking towards a clean future, not only solving climate change, but also urban air pollution problems. funds, which is another issue that's been big on the agenda here. So maybe the penny's beginning to drop in the dear old UK as well. I do hope so, because as we move towards the Brexit door, I do feel that we may find ourselves going down some really unfortunate industrial and economic cul-de-sacs driven by the ideology of taking back control rather than looking forward to some of these big questions that are going to be shaping the global future over the next few decades.
Right, very, very interesting. Just the business, you mentioned the Chinese business. Do you think the business case for sustainability is well and truly proven now?
Oh yes, it's proven at so many levels at once. It's just the ability of executives to be able to see it. And, you know, as I say, this is more or less the case. You've got very kind of broad-thinking leaders like Paul Polman at Unilever, who's understood all the dots and seen the SDGs as the new framework and is building a strategy for one of the world's largest consumer goods companies, basically built upon that. Then you have some others who remain with their head firmly looking backwards rather than forwards, and, you know, in the coal and fossil fuel industry, whereas there should have been a program of transition and moving investments into renewables over recent years, they didn't do it. They're still not doing it, and they're basically in a place of denial, and, you know, this is going to be a cost to them and also to their shareholders, and of course a cost to society at the same time. So you know, the business case is more or less visible depending on who you talk to. But it's got many faces. One is the policy one. You know, if there is going to be a 2-degree pathway and there's a global agreement that says there will be, then fossil fuels are basically finished. Do you expect that in 10 years' time, the 15 and 16-year-olds who are now coming through school and looking at all this stuff on social media, are they going to be buying products from companies that have not responded properly to this? As we enter a period of volatility in environmental terms, you know, do companies have all they need to be able to ride out that volatility? And so, for example, in the chocolate sector, something I've been looking at a little bit lately, there is now a very clear relationship between deforestation and drought, and cocoa requires a lot of rain to grow in the geographies where it grows. And so if you're not paying attention to deforestation as a cocoa company, you're probably putting yourself at risk. There's another business case there. And then, of course, there is the ongoing reputational risk as Greenpeace and Friends of the Earth and others continue to build public support behind their campaigns. And if you're on the wrong side of that, it can do you serious harm, as has been proved the case many times in the past. So the business case is now overwhelming. It's just the ability of executives to be able to see it. And, of course, many of them are not trained in some of this thinking, and so they find it very hard indeed to break out of their very short-term market thinking, which, of course, is still overwhelmingly what is being taught in economics departments and business schools, bizarrely. Actually, I made the point the other day that you shouldn't be allowed to study economics without having first done a degree in ecology. I think we're a little way from that, but nonetheless, I think there's some validity to that view.
Absolutely. I just spoke to Dick Norgaard from the University of Berkeley, who's a fascinating figure and one of the key figures. I came out of Chicago, actually, developing environmental economics back in the 1960s, and a fascinating picture of the need for ecological thinking in economics and so forth. Now, that's a very interesting overview and more in-depth perspective. What you mentioned being more concerned or been more looking more at the solving the problems maybe nowadays rather than, you know, trying to see what's going on. What are a few things on your plate that you're interested in and putting your energy in?
So it remains quite a familiar mix, but with a different set of activities, I guess, in some ways. So I'm still very active in looking at the question of tropical deforestation and what can be done about that. And, you know, this is one place where you can see the narrative has shifted recently. And so, as was the case with so many of these things over the years, you had this view being expressed by companies and politicians that deforestation and other environmental destruction was the price of progress. This is how we have to build economies, and it's a regrettable but inevitable consequence of that. You now have companies and governments saying, actually, we understand that without these forests, we're going to be economically worse off. And so working in that space with one or two countries and some companies is proving very interesting and hopefully productive. Different bits of work going on the marine plastic space or the plastic waste issue more generally, but mostly being driven these days by the buildup of plastics in the marine environment, and this is obviously now a very public question, which is now driving consumer awareness, which in turns, in terms of consumer goods companies, is really quite a big challenge. And so how are we going to fix that? And one of the things I'm increasingly seeing on that side is how we need a systemic and joined up approach to that problem. We're not going to solve it through one company doing a bit more recycling or somebody else doing a little bit more consumer awareness. This is about the whole system. It's about the production of the material, the use by consumers, and then the waste management system that gets it back again. I mean, it's a great example actually of the circular economy thinking that needs to emerge, whereby not only do you have one actor, i.e. a manufacturer, doing the new kind of business model, but you need everybody, and that obviously is a real challenge now. This is about building consensus, common cause across sectors, and actually that's another common feature I think of the emerging world on sustainability, is the need for whole corporate and consumer and policy ecosystems to be working together rather than in isolation or worse still in opposition to each other, which has been the case evidently. And also some interesting work going on the question of low carbon energy, with one piece there looking at the role for biomass and wood pellets and the extent to which that's part of the solution going forward, and obviously then linking back to forestry and land use and everything else. So quite a mixed bag, but one that's rather different to what I was doing a decade ago, which was really still at that stage trying to get different groups and organizations to be even saying that they needed to do something. So I think we're in a positive place in that sense, but evidently nowhere near yet the end of the road.
Yes, well, it sounds like you've got a very full plate. Now, looking at the ways of dealing with the problems, and you emphasise clearly the hugely important role of policy, also of partnerships. I'm just wondering, can we talk a little bit about technology? It evokes strong feelings. I think many see it as a silver bullet, a lot of money going into different technologies. Others more concerned, and certainly we've seen, you know, some social major social problems coming out of some of the technology platforms, I think, have got some responsibility there. Yeah. What's your sense of the relative importance of technology in dealing with environment and the climate change? Very big question. I know
it's a huge question, but I think the short answer is that it will be central to what needs to happen, but that it can't do it on its own. You know, and actually, I remember this debate very well during the period on the climate change issue at the global level over the early 2000s, when there was a school of thought, very prominent, free market driven very often, and, you know, anti-regulation, that said, you know, the climate change issue is only going to be solved by technology, therefore you don't need global agreements to do it, just forget all this targets and timetables nonsense. Then on the other side, you had various people saying, well, you know, we have to have a political agreement, otherwise there'll be no certainty. And the reality of it was that you can't reach a global agreement without having the technology, and the technology is not going to get to scale without a global agreement. And so you kind of finish up realizing that it's both and, I would say, and that if you do want to conserve tropical rainforest, cut carbon dioxide emissions, eliminate waste and go to a circular economy, to do all this in a very efficient, smart way, then we're going to need a lot of technology. And so, you know, that's my basic kind of conclusion. But then, you know, you know that technology isn't going to work unless there is backing from the policymakers giving the right kinds of long-term signals, and also the right kind of culture and behavior. And so, you know, even with the best recycling facilities in the world, you know, if I pick up a bottle of water in the shop and don't put it in a recycling bin and instead chuck it in the river, you know, this is saying something about the cultural norms that have to shift at the same time as we have state-of-the-art circular economy technologies to turn bottles back into bottles. You know, we're increasingly able to do that, but as long as people are still throwing these things into the environment, which they do on an epic scale, then evidently, you know, the cultural piece also has to be part of the solution. And then, of course, you know, as we enter this kind of fourth industrial revolution, as some people call it, you've got this kind of synergy between digital, nano, bio, technology, technologies and nanotechnologies and everything else, you know, there is a huge jobs issue here as we move towards a different and more efficient, hopefully more efficient economy. So, for example, you know, if we did move towards super smart electric vehicles that use energy very sensibly, which are being driven by computers, you know, there's going to be a lot of people who drive for a living whose jobs are going to be at risk, and we've got to factor that into this as we go forward. Otherwise, we're going to be potentially helping to take the edge off of environmental issues, but creating the most almighty social problems at the same time, and we have to avoid that at all costs.
Well, absolutely. And it's very interesting you say that. And I guess this question of technologies and the returns to technologies, I mean, certainly we've seen with platforms, some of these platform technologies, the main beneficiaries perhaps have been shareholders, yes, private equity or venture capital, who somehow managed to kind of capitalize on all of the information, yeah, that's in the system. I'm wondering about the governance of technology. I mean, it's a very thriving investment market in the West Coast and so forth. Is it fit for purpose? Do we need to think about other kinds of governance? Another broad question.
Well, we did. Well, I think companies need to be thinking about business models and the social impact of those, as well as, you know, the profitability and the environmental side. And actually, Fergal, it's very interesting you just mentioned that issue there about, you know, shareholders and the extent to which, you know, the benefits to the new technology are going to fall in certain places more than others. I've reached the conclusion over the years that possibly the biggest environmental issue that nobody talks about at all is inequality, and the extent to which the great divisions that have emerged between the very well-off and the less well-off actually are a major problem in all sorts of ways. And, you know, you see the extent to which people are being excluded from progress causes them to react badly and therefore to stop policy happening. And I think it's fair to say that, you know, that the part of Donald Trump's platform of anti-environmentalism and speaking up for coal miners is exploiting that sense of exclusion that's felt by a lot of people. And so when you know you need to change policy, that there are people who can stop it happening simply by dint of appealing to people who feel as though they've been sidelined. And the same thing has happened in this country on energy efficiency with groups advocating for poor people saying, well, we can't go down this energy efficiency route, it's going to put bills up for poor people, and renewable energy is not an affordable cost for people on low incomes, and hardworking families can't afford it. All of that narrative only gets traction when you've got such big divisions between different groups of people. So that's a huge bit of the problem. And you see it globally. It's less evident now because things have moved on. But, you know, for 20 years in the climate negotiations, the differences between the rich and the poor countries was the main reason why nothing could be agreed. And so, you know, it was holding up fundamentally the progress that needed to be made. And then you look at some of the, you know, the trends that are shaping the modern world, the rise of middle class consumers, the poor everywhere for good reason want to have a car, a nice house, go on aeroplanes and everything else. That simply is not going to be possible to accommodate. And so again, you've got this psychological problem which emerges from differences between people, or where everybody wants to be as well off as the most well off, and that manifestation of inequality drives behavior in ways which again are completely antithetical to what we need to do in reducing environmental impact. So this is a huge, massive thing. And if the technology that we adopt in the future makes this worse by excluding people from the benefits of progress, then the political difficulties and the psychological difficulties of moving forward are going to be all the bigger. And this is something that's hardly talked about in the sustainability space, but one of the things I do think we have to have on the table going forward, and which is going to have to be central to this whole question of how we harness technology, because if this finishes up just making the group of multi-billionaire tech giants who, you know, they were in the news again this week, the richest people in the world now are basically running Google, Amazon, Microsoft, Apple, these kinds of companies. If these purveyors of technology finish up concentrating wealth even more into their institutions at the same time as destroying jobs elsewhere, then that inequality piece is going to run headlong straight into the so-called environmental solutions coming from technology, and they will stop, because that will be a political and social barrier that will be more powerful than even the cleverest data heads in Silicon Valley.
That's fascinating. And I know that I spoke to Doug Rushkoff, who wrote Throwing Stones at the Google Bus, and he talks about some of this question of, you know, the platform technologies and so forth. And he's pointed out that there are cooperatively owned alternatives to many of the platforms out there, and yet they haven't reached the same kind of scale or anything like that.
This brings in the discussion around different kinds of not only business models, but also different kinds of institutions. And so the B Corp idea and having companies that are not only there for the profitability of the shareholder, but bringing social benefits. And that potentially is going to be one way in which some of this can become more joined up. And again, this then, I think, reinforces the point of the business case we were talking about earlier on, because the more these things do become apparent to different people in positions to bring forward new kinds of ideas, then the more the incumbency and the established organizations become vulnerable to being outflanked and sidelined as better ideas emerge. And so I do think that investors, big organizations who think they might be part of the solution, they've got to keep their eye on this wider set of questions rather than simply going down rabbit burrows of particular technologies that might look quite good individually, but actually in the end might be helping to exacerbate a systemic set of issues that in the end will mean they can't work.
Well, that's right. And the profit motive is, it creates a lot of momentum, but also, you know, big problems as well. And I'm just wondering, what hope do you see for new models emerging like this? I mean, you see lots of talk of big impact investors investing in these projects, but and private equity moving in there and so forth. And, you know, there is a question to be asked there, really, in some cases, in many cases, you know, is this really impact investment? Is this, what's the concessionary element of this? Is this just like any other private equity investment, a virgin territory where you can create, you know, monopoly companies and things like that?
Well, I think I guess in the end this is going to depend on our collective ability to do synthesis as well as analysis, if I can put it like that, because the modern kind of competence that we need to grow is being able to take the broad view and to synthesize between different issues, as we're discussing here, between climate, between job creation, between technology, between investment, between politics, and to be taking the sweep of view across all of that and joining it together rather than going down particular routes that don't see this wider set of connections. And I think, you know, the tendency in Western societies over the last very long period, actually a couple of hundred years, has been to encourage knowing more and more about less and less, and to get ultra specialization and to be able to see very specific opportunities and to pursue them in isolation from the bigger view. And this sustainability question that we're discussing now, and which is, you know, the big issue of our age, I think it's going to require people to think a little bit more broadly and more kind of comprehensively in integrated, holistic ways. And that's something that we've lost the ability to do in many cases. And certainly many of the companies I work with, they find it very hard to do that. They're dealing with a particular challenge, crisis that's on their desk today. And they find it very hard to step back and see that particular crisis is on their desk today is going to be the most almighty crisis in a several years' time. And that in order to avoid that, it's going to require a different approach to the one that they've become used to, which is crisis management, doing specific things to deal with what they see as a specific issue. So that, I think, is the big question. And how do we train people to do that? Well, I would say that, you know, economics departments and business schools, I mentioned them earlier on, there's certainly a place there for those kinds of bodies to be fostering this ability to take the systemic view, to do systems thinking, rather than to be training people in how to run a spreadsheet or to how to generate profit out of a particular enterprise. That no longer is sufficient, not if we're going to have a sustainable future.
Right. You mentioned the SDGs and the tremendous momentum there as a framework. Do you think that, I don't know how familiar you are with this particular aspect, but do you think there's scope there for this more systemic element? Because there seems to be a lot of very, very worthy goals in there, but I don't know what the process is to measure trade-offs and to consider these other systemic questions.
Yeah, well, I think that the very powerful thing about the SDGs is the extent to which they are a comprehensive package. So you've got everything in there from jobs through to conserving biodiverse ecosystems, and that has to be the right way of looking at all of this, and putting them out there as a group that you see all at once hopefully will be something that people can begin to respond to, and everyone will have different choices and trade-offs, and actually hopefully the idea of trade-offs will begin to diminish as we start to look for, you know, sweet spots and the integrated kind of idea of where the best place is to put yourself as a consumer goods company or as an energy company or as somebody who makes apparel, whatever it would be. Hopefully the mindset that emerges from the SDGs takes us more away from that idea of, you know, that there are places where we have to kind of like, you know, trade this against that, and to say actually this is the sweet spot where we need to be moving in the future to achieve a net benefit for society and the environment. I'm not sure how close we are to that yet, but, you know, again, I say I get glimpses of people evidently taking this kind of view, and the more we get of that, then perhaps the more optimistic that we can be about our ability to solve some of these things.
Fascinating. I don't know whether we could slip in one question. We talk about technology. We've covered an awful lot of ground here. Very rich discussion. Geoengineering is another very controversial topic. Do you have a point of view on that?
It depends. I mean, there's such a range of ideas that are kind of, you know, in the geoengineering heading, that it's difficult to be very general about it and make any sense. But I fear that if we waste the next 15 to 20 years and don't do all that we need to do, then we may finish up in a position where we've got no option but to start looking at some of those things, depending on what they are. But they all come in different ways with risks and downsides that potentially could have very serious consequences. And so I think probably the smart thing would be to avoid having to do that. And we've still got time, just about, it seems, to be able to go on a crash low carbon trajectory, and to do that as our best, probably cheapest and certainly safest option of being able to lay the foundations for a secure future. I think the geoengineering piece is not going to go away. It will be on the table, and it will become more or less prominent depending on how successful we are over the next period. And so I think that's where we need to focus.
Right. Are you optimistic, Tony? I know the pace of change, you talk about the momentum and so forth, but there are clearly some who say, you know, we really need to be moving a lot faster, and are, you know, I know, yes. At John Elkington and so forth, they talk about, yes, this more exponential approach. Yes. Where how do you feel?
I regard it as a professional competence to be relentlessly optimistic. I do think that we get further quicker if we can paint a positive picture of how we're going to get there and the chances of getting there. And so what we're dealing with is so complicated and so sprawling that, you know, you do need to take that kind of gut view of it, because once you get into the detail, anything could happen. I mean, literally anything could happen. And so if you look at the mega trends there, from the population, economic growth, resource, climate point of view, and biodiversity, then it doesn't look too good. But then again, if you look at the opportunities we have to bring forward things we've already invented, never mind to innovate and go further, then you can see that actually it could be done, so long as those different groupings that we talked about earlier, the governments, the companies and the public, can get aligned to the point where all of this can go very quickly. It could happen. But then again, it may not. But I think, you know, it is incumbent, it's our duty for those of us who see this, to say that it can be done, and indeed that it will be done. And certainly that remains my kind of day-to-day perspective on it. Because actually, the other thing to bear in mind is that if you look at the scale of what's needed and then the chances of us getting there in time, then probably the quickest and surest way of making sure we don't do it is to be pessimistic and to say that it can't be done, which is, you know, plausible through some readings of the information that we have, but I'd be inclined not to say it.
Well, Tony, that optimism is very infectious, and thank you so much for sharing your perspective, the wealth of insights, and all the work you've been doing and your vision for the future with me today.
My pleasure, Fergal. Thank you.
Thank you for having me there.
Thank you for listening to the Sustainability Agenda podcast. I hope you found it interesting. Please sign up at the sustainabilityagenda.com website or on iTunes to make sure you don't miss any future episodes.